Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So if I say the words avocado and harvest gold, do you travel in time back to your 1970s kitchen? Does Loudon Green and Leather Brown bring Frank Lloyd Wright to mind? We've talked to the people at Pantone before about their color predictions for the coming year. Now they've got a book that looks back at the last century through the design palettes of each decade. The book is called Pantone, the 20th Century in Color. And joining me now is Keith Recker, who co-wrote the book with Leatrice Eisenman. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
And listeners, if you were paying attention to what I just said, I gave you some strong hints for the quiz we have up on our website, letting you try to match three sets of colors to their decades. So you'll definitely want to see this as we talk about the book. 212—you can call in too, but the quiz is on our webpage. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show for the Name That Decade Color Scheme Quiz. This is a fun project, but it also tells us things about ourselves and our country. Do you have a favorite palette from the last century?
Gosh, that's a good question. It changes pretty much every day. Today, I think I'm really in love with this palette that's almost the centerfold of the book called Cosmetic Superstars, about the super glamorous hot red that the 50s really embraced in cosmetics and fashion and even to some degree home design.
Pantone is in the business of standardizing and labeling colors so that designers can refer to their Pantone color charts to specify a shade and everyone's on the same page, right?
That's exactly what you do. Yes, that's exactly right. We have a palette of a couple thousand colors that we've specified in printing inks, in fabric dyes, in powder coats, plastics, and more, so that, in fact, a designer can dream up everything that they're capable of dreaming and communicate with everybody along the process to get exactly what they want at the end of the process.
But since it didn't get started until the 1960s, in doing this book and looking back to even earlier palettes, did you find any uncharted colors?
You know, that's a really interesting question. Yes and no. I'm not supposed to say yes. But of course, there are always those funny notes in between the piano keys that you can't quite quantify. But we did our best to actually go back and really look at actual objects that represent each decade and, of course, find the corresponding Pantone colors. The text, of course, hinges on the psychological, social, emotional moment that those colors express. So we're really looking to bring the visual and the historical together.
Listeners, anything you want to say about this, call us up, 212-433-WNYC. Is there a color or is there a set of colors that you associate with a period of time in your life that you associate maybe with your mother or your grandmother because those colors are what were in for design at the time that they put their homes together or anything like that? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And we were just talking about grunge musician Chris Cornell. Describe these color spreads in the book. You've grouped the colors into sets like grunge and graffiti from the 1990s, yes, or Sesame Street from the 1960s, or film noir from the 1940s. And then you have photos showing how that palette showed up. And there are many palettes for each decade. I mean, from this distance, could you discern sociological changes through color schemes? Were the 1930s muted because it was a depression era? Was there a lot of red, white, and blue during World War II? Anything like that?
You know, it's interesting. Actually, we saw to a huge degree the opposite in the 1930s, that people were so desperately in need of cheer and buoying up and catching on fire a little bit so that they could figure out how to survive the next day. A lot of the colors are saturated, jewel-like brights that are meant to amuse and meant to distract. Think about Dorothy's ruby slippers in 1939, Wizard of Oz, with the Emerald City. Think how saturated those colors were.
Earth tones in one decade are often different from another. Both the 1970s Harvest Gold palette and the 1900s Arts and Crafts palette featured earth tones. But I don't know how to describe this in words for the radio audience. They look different from each other and, in effect, they reflect different times.
They are different from each other. Yeah, I think if you look at the Arts and Crafts palette from the 1910s, that's the 1900s, you'll see a certain relaxed and very natural quality. And in fact, the arts and crafts movement was supposed to reincorporate virtues from an earlier era into its way of being, its languorous way of looking at things and living. It's great, gorgeous palette. If you look at the 1970s with its avocado green, you see a totally different moment. The 70s inherited the wild confusion of the 60s, even as it inherited the environmental movement and the first attempt to control pesticides and legislate for clean air and water. So the 70s had to grapple with confusion and this sort of increasing principle about being responsible. And we have this funny avocado green as a result.
So there's a set of brighter greens mm-hmm. in the 1970s Earth Tones palette.
Very intense.
And a much more muted set in the 1900s.
Yes.
Eileen, on Cape Cod, you're on WNYC. Hi, Eileen. Eileen, are you there?
I'm a freelance graphic designer. And often when I show someone a job that has a color scheme that's not exactly what they expect, they'll look at it and they'll see a color and they'll say, oh my God, that looks like my grandmother's sofa. And they'll hate it. And no matter what I do, I can't get over that emotional connection that they have with that color and associating it with like a 70s couch or, like you were saying, an avocado green refrigerator or something like that. And it's so strong, you know?
And so as a designer, are you more open to it?
Yeah, I think I have a very different perspective. And I don't hate any color. And I don't understand when somebody really viscerally hates a color. I think every color has a place somewhere.
It's a little bit like Proust and the Madeleine. You never know what's going to set you off into this long train of association. And once that train leaves the station, it's really hard to get somebody off of it. It's if they've decided that that's their grandmother's sofa and that was the epitome of not so chic, you never really get them to change their mind. It's interesting to get them to look across the color wheel at something else for a while. So if they're fixed on avocado green, go to some complex orange for a little while and see if you can't get them off it.
Leslie in Pottersville, New Jersey. You know there's a Pottersville, New York, too, Leslie.
Well, I'm in New Jersey.
How you doing?
I'm good. I just wanted to comment that I really do feel that colors are the decades. I grew up in South Jersey in the mid-80s. I was in high school, and we used to frequent diners. And at that time, there was this big push for redecorating all the diners, and everything was teal and mauve for that mid-80s, late 80s in the diners.
So why was that, Keith?
You know, there was a moment actually in the 80s where I think Time magazine had an article called The Mauving of America, because mauve just absolutely took over. It inherited all of that fervor that avocado green had for a moment. It's almost like people had to walk away from that avocado green from exhaustion, and they settled on mauve. For a little while, mauve resonated with a kind of earthy authenticity, a kind of Southwest freedom, a little bit of sparseness in the middle of that decade of plenty and excess and big hair and big shoulders. It was perceived as a little bit of a rest, but it too was overdone and people had to run away from it eventually as well.
Leslie, thank you. Good example. Don, I'm sorry, in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC. Hi, Don.
Yes, hi. Good to talk to you. First of all, I love the Pantone colors. They're wonderful. The problem I have is I'm a union scenic artist and I also own Artistic Effects, a decorative painting company. And especially in the entertainment business, if we're given Pantone color to reproduce in the real world, in paint, often latex paint, we have to juice it with fluorescent to get anywhere close to it because it's such brilliant color. It really is more of a print or dye color. I was just curious if they're aware of that issue. A lot of us face that every day.
It's true. We are aware of that issue. And there's a company up in Vermont called Fine Paints of Europe, which is really capable of getting extremely close to Pantone value. So I would actually look them up. It's a great resource.
Ciro in Garfield. You're on WNYC. Hello, Ciro.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I reflected back in the 50s when I was growing up, young boy, and my mother and a whole bunch of people in the neighborhood in Little Italy were obsessed with charcoal gray and pink. And we all the boys ran around in these light pink shirts with these charcoal gray ties. And it seemed to be a trend for a short period of time. I think started in the spring in the mid-50s.
Ciro, thank you very much.
It's true, actually, that that's definitely something that we talk about in the book. There are two palettes. One's called Movie Goddesses and one's called Cosmetic Superstars. And we talk in Movie Goddesses about the invention of Eastman Kodak's 35-millimeter processing system, which allowed all of a sudden the movies not to just be in color but to have a delicate, beautiful range of colors. And Audrey Hepburn and Grace Kelly really profited from that beautiful aquamarine, soft pink, gray palette that was now possible. And I actually think a lot of moms loved those two ladies so much that they ended up sort of emulating the movies that the ladies were in.
Keith Recker, co-author of Pantone, The 20th Century in Colors. And listeners, you can take our Name That Decade Color Scheme quiz on our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. In fact, you can see there the contrast that we were talking about before between 1970s earth tones and 1900s earth tones. Film noir brings up an interesting side note. These movies that were in black and white, so people might be surprised by how colorful the 30s and 40s were if they, you know, were looking at movie images. But you have palettes called film noir.
Yes, we do have a palette called film noir. How could we not? It's such an evocative way of milking every non-color for the drama that's inherent in it. So we do have a range of whites and blacks, but we did slip in a red because we noticed in movie posters that were publicizing film noir pieces, there's always this shocking red, and we found a Pantone value code high risk red, which seemed absolutely appropriate to denote that presence.
Leah in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. This is so funny because just the subject matter is just so relevant. And I wanted to let your guests know that I have a Pantone color booklet in my house that all my children play with constantly because they seem to be fascinated by the depth of color. But I just wanted to note that, you know, the avocado green is sort of, you know, historical, but the green that I always associate with my sort of coming of age in the early to mid 80s is this Kelly, like this Irish Kelly green that used to be in the carpeting of the homes of my really wealthy friends. I grew up in Massachusetts, north of Boston, and I just grew up in this wealthy town and had a lot of well-to-do friends. And I just remember this almost Kelly green carpeting that they would have in their homes, which I could never figure out because it just didn't seem right, but I always associate that color, mm-hmm. especially in you know, home textiles with, you know, ostentatious, the well-to-do. I don't know. It's just kind of funny.
And of that time. And I wonder if they would use the Kelly green today. Probably they'd have wood floors.
Kelly green came back. I think Kelly green for me is a reference to billiard tables and golf courses. You know, that sort of beautiful,
lush,
creamy, exactly, sense of luxury and leisure. And it really was very popular. And it came back in the 80s as a part of the whole preppy movement. There's a definite crimson and a definite hunter green that Ralph Lauren and others helped popularize it. And so it continued to stand for something quite lush.
By the way, after you mentioned it, we looked up and tweeted a link to The Moving of America, New York Times Magazine, 1991.
Excellent.
So as sometimes happens with that publication, it took them a while to catch up. But we have a minute left. The book is The 20th Century in Colors through Pantone. What about today?
It's interesting. We're thinking a lot today about somehow balancing the need to proclaim your personality with super hot colors, which you see on the catwalks these days, and the need to be responsible from an environmental point of view, from an economic point of view, from a spiritual point of view. And so this combination of proclaiming and trumpeting versus actually being a little demure and a little withdrawn, we see both impulses happening at the same time. So neon brights and beautiful tweeds and charcoals and softer values.
All right. Less today with the Times Magazine than 1991. But Pantone, The 20th Century in Color, co-author Keith Recker. This has been so much fun.
Thank you so much.
And listeners, you can still take our Name That Decade Color Scheme quiz at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show.